Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, a changing role for Bethlehem University in the future of Palestinian society. We hear from Vice Chancellor Brother Peter Bray. And 1 year on from the independence of South Sudan, conflict and a growing humanitarian crisis continues to challenge the work of aid agencies there. A beacon of hope for the future of Palestinian society. That's how Bethlehem University sees its mission, almost 40 years on from its founding by the De La Salle Christian Brothers in 1973. The brothers first began opening schools in Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Jaffna, and Nazareth back at the end of the 19th century. But it was after the historic visit of Pope Paul VI in 1964 that Palestinians asked for an institute of higher learning, one that has just been recognized by the International Federation of Catholic Universities for its high academic standards. Despite being closed 12 times by Israeli authorities during its short history, and in spite of the difficulties facing many of the students and staff on a daily basis, the university continues to offer a vision of a brighter future for young Christian and Muslim men and women.
I think one of the biggest challenges we have is to keep hope alive. And so we talk about Bethlehem University as being a beacon of hope.
Brother Peter Bray has been Vice Chancellor of Bethlehem University since 2009. He told me more about the changing focus for the institution today.
When Bethlehem University was started in 1973, it met the need the Palestinians had then for university education. And as you say, for almost 40 years, we've been providing that quality higher education. One of the things that has been evident in the last few years, though, is that there are other needs that Palestinians have. And one of the things that I've been doing is asking people in Bethlehem, but other parts of Palestine, people in the Palestinian Authority, the Prime Minister, diplomats around the world. And what's come through is that Bethlehem University can play a significant role in helping to build this nation. And as the Prime Minister has mentioned to me, there are a huge number of things that are needed to build the nation. And I think Bethlehem University has to be realistic. And so there are, of all of those things, there are some things that Bethlehem University can do and can do very well. And so that's what we are going to concentrate on.
So give us an idea of what those priorities would be then for the coming years.
Okay, we have in place at present a Master's in International Cooperation and Development, which is looking at how the economic life of Palestine can be advanced. And that has established itself, and somebody just told me this last week, as not only the best program in Palestine, but the best of its nature in the whole Middle East. So it's established itself as a high-quality master's program. The other thing that we have already applied for is a master's in governance and public administration. And the Prime Minister in particular is very, very keen on this. And this is aimed at people who are already in local government, municipalities, and in the Palestinian National Authority, to give them a background and a framework as to how do you manage this country. So we've made application for that. We're waiting for the Ministry of Higher Education to provide us with the go-ahead to put that in place.
So not just graduate students coming through your university, but people coming for retraining.
Yeah. Well, there'll be some, hopefully, that'll come through, but what we have done with the MECAD program is to insist on a certain level of experience. So what we would want is people who are already in positions in local authorities, in the municipalities and the national authority. And the idea is that based on that experience, we would provide a framework. Now, it's a master's program, so people would need to have a bachelor's background in order to take part in that. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is this has been highly emphasised by the ambassador in Washington, a master's in diplomacy and foreign service. because many of the people who are in Foreign Service have had very little background in it. Now, we're working with a significant university in the United States at present in developing a program. Now, what I emphasise is that I don't want to bring the program they have to Bethlehem. What I want is to be able to use the expertise that they have to link up with people in the Palestinian authorities, with some ambassadors, with people from Bethlehem University, and have them sit down, and the president of this university is prepared to do that, have them sit down and figure out what's the best possible program that we can put in place at Bethlehem University that's best going to serve the Palestinian people. So that's a little further down the track, but that's another thing that we have in place. And two other, not directly connected with that, is we have a Master's in Social Work that we've already applied for, and next January we start a Master's in Tourism Management. So that, in terms of the economic value that it will be to people, is quite significant as well. Now, we feel that those things are ways in which Bethlehem University can make a significant contribution to the building of the nation of Palestine.
So a significant development of your programmes, there's also been a significant number in the increase in students, hasn't there?
Well, over the last 8 or 10 years, yes. From, I think, about 8 or 9 years ago, there were about 1,700, 1,800. And now we've, for the last 3 years, been over the 3,000. So that's put pressure on the campus that we have. And so we need to look at how do we relieve that pressure, and how do we branch out into those other graduate programs. And so we're looking at the possibility of purchasing a land nearby to enable us to make that expansion.
How are you managing the funding for all this? Because it's a constant problem, and particularly for you there at Bethlehem University.
Yeah. Well, with difficulty. I think we have some extraordinary support from around the world, and there are people in the United States that are really working very hard for us, and in Canada, and also here in Europe. We have at present a campaign for $40 million underway, which is going to help us with this. But I'd have to say that the way the Franciscans in the Holy Land have responded, the Custos and the custody and people there, have been a great encouragement to us, and will, I think, enable us to bring this purchase to fruition.
You're playing an increasingly important role there in the development of Palestinian society. The challenge for anybody graduating from your school or from the master's programmes is, of course, employment.
Right, yeah. Well, that's one of the real difficulties in Bethlehem. You know, the employment or unemployment rate there is up around in the 20%. And that is one of the challenges that we have. We have started up a program of mentoring and trying to work with local industry. One of our graduates has a partner in Britain and another partner in the United States, and has opened up a call centre in Bajala. I think there is something like 19 of our graduates who are employed there, and they're hoping over the next 2 or 3 years that they'd get up to 65. So that's a single instance. But another one that I'm particularly pleased about is that two of our graduates, who are husband and wife, who live in Maryland and in the United States, have employed two other graduates in Maryland. But the exciting thing is that last year they employed two people in Bethlehem. They have a computer IT company. And so from Maryland, they're employing people in Bethlehem, and they're able to stay in Bethlehem and be employed by that company. So there are some creative ways in which people are looking at providing employment. But the fact is, Israel controls the economy, and it's very, very difficult for people to find ways to start up new companies and to employ our graduates. And so we lose a lot of them to the Gulf, to Jordan. But the disappointing fact is that, you know, the vast majority of them would love to stay in Palestine. But, you know, they've got to eat. So, you know, they need a job somewhere.
How How do you convince people in this situation to think of a future in Palestine, to stay there when there seems to be so little hope on the political front still?
I think one of the biggest challenges we have is to keep hope alive. And so we talk about Bethlehem University as being a beacon of hope. And I think that one of the things we need to keep looking at are the things that are working, the things that, you know, like the two examples I mentioned. But the other thing is, you know, just if you look at the political situation, if you go back to the original Zionist plan of 1919, you know, that has not happened. You know, it took in part of Lebanon, a significant part of Syria and Jordan and parts of Egypt. But that is a success, that, you know, that didn't happen. The other thing is the wall. The wall originally was to take 3 years to build and to cost around about $2 billion. It's now 10 years. It hasn't been finished. It's only about 60% finished. And it's cost $8 billion. And the restrictions on that have been because of protests. So there are things that, you know, it's very easy to get into a downward spiral and think everything's coming unstuck. And I think there's a need to focus on things that are working and not to be unrealistic about what the restrictions are and the impact they have, but to see that it's worth fighting for, that it's worth holding out, that Palestine is something that is very, very dear to these people, and we've got to find ways in which we can support them in that. And I think, you know, what we are doing at Bethlehem University, we've created an oasis of peace there for them, so that when they come on campus, they know that they're safe, they know that there are people there who care about them, and we're a beacon of hope for them, and we're a provider of quality higher education.
Keeping hope alive comes at a high cost for all the staff at Bethlehem University. Brother Peter tells me without doubt it's the hardest job he's ever done in his life, dealing with the ongoing occupation and the problems that presents for so many of his students. And yet, trying to hold back the tears, he tells me it's the students themselves who provide him with the inspiration to carry forward the De La Salle vision of education and dignity for all.
I suppose one of the things that really inspires me and makes it all worthwhile for me is the incredible resilience of the students. I was speaking to one young woman in June of last year, just before she graduated. She was a fourth-year student from East Jerusalem. And I was saying to her, well, what's it like being a student at Bethlehem University from East Jerusalem, having to come through the wall twice a day? And she said some nice things about Bethlehem University. And then she said, the worst thing is coming in the bus up to the checkpoint and wondering, this time, what's it going to be? Are they going to wave the bus through? Is a soldier going to get on and just take a look at their IDs? Is a soldier going to get on and take all their IDs and have them sit there for a half an hour and a half? Are they going to be herded off the bus and made to stand in the sun while their IDs are going to be checked? Are they going to be individually interrogated? Are they going to be strip searched? All of those things have happened to her. So when she's in the bus coming up to the checkpoint, she's wondering, this time, what's it going to be? And yet every day she came back to Bethlehem University. You know, and it's
an incredible witness these students are providing, isn't it?
And it's that sort of resilience, that sort of determination that no matter what, you know, this education is so important to them. And as another one said to me at one stage, you know, the Israelis have taken their land, they've taken their home, they're taking their freedom, but they can't take away their education. And so that's why it's such an important thing for them. And, you know, this is an example of Balanti Assam, the young woman from Gaza in October 2009, was stopped at the checkpoint and then handcuffed, blindfolded and dumped back in Gaza in the middle of the night. And yet her determination to finish and graduate, you know, it, for me, that sort of thing and just the commitment that they have to their education. And, you know, I've said to many people, this is by far the most difficult job I've ever had in terms of the restrictions, in terms of the hassles that we have to go through and all that sort of thing. But I've never been in a, never, and all the things I've done, I've never been in a place where it's so obvious that what we're doing is worthwhile.
Do you think it's possible to talk about education as the new name of peace?
Well, yeah, that's a way of talking about it. I think education is the basis on which any peace will grow. And I hope I'm not naive, but I have a hope that what we do at Bethlehem University, particularly with the interfaith thing, you know, we have 70% Muslim, 30% Christian, that every student has to take a program in religious studies where together they look at Christianity, Islam and Judaism. Now, in their high school, the Muslims went off and studied the Quran, the Christians went off and studied the Bible or religious education, but they never ever did it together. But we insist that they sit side by side, they follow this program. And many Muslims have said to me, well, I didn't realise that's what Christianity was about, and vice versa for the Christians. And I have this naive hope that as a result of being there together, they go back into their communities and start to undermine some of the prejudices that exist there. And I think, you know, coming together like that in a place where it's possible for them to share with one another, like one professor told me just last week, the two of his students, a Muslim and a Christian, are almost inseparable. You know, that they are able, in the environment that we've created there, to be together and to come to understand one another. And he was reminiscing, he's an older man, he was reminiscing back to what it was like before 48, where Christians and Muslims, often he didn't know whether they're Christians or Muslims. You know, they got on so well together in that environment then. Mm.
So there's a hope that this will lead to a future of peace.
I think that unless we have that sort of expectation, why would you try to do things? So, you know, I suppose, you know, without sounding pious or whatever, that, you know, Jean-Baptiste de La Salle, our founder, towards the end of his life, after spending his whole life trying to get the brothers established and the schools going, there was a real possibility that the whole thing would collapse and his life's work would disappear. And his attitude then was, Lord, the work is yours. And, you know, and then for 300 years the brothers have existed and carried on the La Salleian spirit. And I suppose from my perspective, you know, I've been there a while now. I'm not sure how much longer I'll be there. But this is a little blip in the history of Bethlehem University. And it's not my agenda. It's not my work. And so I'll use all my abilities and talents and energy. But in the last analysis, it's the Lord's work. And so that, I find, is a really freeing thing that, you know, it doesn't depend on me. And there have been things that have been disasters since I've been there, and there are things that I just can't believe how they've turned out. And it comes back to, you know, daring to believe that I can step out in faith. And so this new venture, I'm stepping out in faith and encouraging other people to do it, daring to believe that the Spirit is there working with us.
My thanks there to Brother Peter Bray, Vice-Chancellor of Bethlehem University. And if you want to find out more or support the work of the university, you can find them on the web at www.bethlehem.edu. One year on from the independence of South Sudan, the needs and the challenges facing people in the world's newest nation remain immense. That's according to the Global Catholic Confederation Caritas Internationalis, which runs both emergency aid programs and longer-term development projects there. Caritas Communications Officer Laura Sheehan has just returned from a fact-finding visit to the border area of Abyei, where fighting flared a year ago as both Khartoum and the southern forces sought control ahead of the Declaration of Independence on July the 9th. Expectations then ran very high, and Laura says there's still a new sense of self-determination, despite the vast needs for infrastructure, electricity, clean water, or health and education systems. She shared with me some heartrending stories, but also some examples of courage and an indomitable will to help build peace in this resource-rich nation.
We went to various places in South Sudan, but our first stop was right on the border. And there were areas where people had basically fled attacks last year in May 2011. Their homes were destroyed. They were running in the night from bombs. And they all sort of fled south about a half hour, an hour's drive, where now over 100,000 people are staying basically in this sort of wasteland area, no electricity, not much shelter. Caritas is helping them build shelters, not much health care. So it's very difficult.
What kind of stories did you hear from people? Many of these had fled there, but had also had stories of fleeing for the past 10, 20, 30 years.
It's true. A lot of these people have really been unwanted in various parts of the area. They've been in different places and basically been sent away or forced to run for their lives. One woman's story was particularly heartrending because she had lived in Khartoum for quite a while, then lived in a place called Abyei for a few months. And then when that place was attacked, she had to run with her children and her mother to save their lives. And they were walking in the heat for days as they escaped, and they didn't have a lot of water. They had no food. And the mother, who was somewhat ill to begin with, she actually died on the journey. And when they got to a place where they thought they could stay, the community there wouldn't let them stay, wouldn't let them bury the mother there. So they actually had to keep going to another place just to bury the mother. So it was really a sad situation. And this is repeated over and over again for thousands of people.
What kind of help, what kind of support is Caritas giving to these communities?
It depends on the area of South Sudan. In the border areas, as I said, we're helping with shelter. We're helping people build sort of thatch huts with, we're giving them poles and plastic sheeting for the roof because there are severe rains at certain times of the year. We're also giving out just emergency supplies like mosquito nets. Malaria is a serious problem. It's a huge killer of people in South Sudan. We're giving mosquito nets, buckets, pieces of cloth that people can use to make clothing or use as sheets or blankets. So we're giving them just the basic supplies they need to live for the time being. One thing we're also doing is we're teaching the teachers, who many of them know Arabic, we're teaching them English because the language of the new country is English. So these are good teachers and they know what they're doing, but they just don't know the new curriculum. So there are so many challenges in this new nation, basic challenges of not having electricity or roads or water systems, the challenges of a whole new government, a whole new school curriculum. So it's a lot of work for a lot of people. And I was really impressed with the courage of the South Sudanese people, who just felt like we have to build the nation.
And yet so difficult in a country which, as you say, lacks almost everything from the most basic infrastructure to any kind of security.
Exactly. It's a very dangerous country on many levels, not just because of the fact that people have guns or because there are still unexploded bombs or landmines, but simply the bugs and the insects, the mosquitoes, the tsetse flies. I think there's still a bit of guinea worm there. The water isn't clean. The roads aren't good. So if you're a woman and you're about to have a baby and you need to get to a clinic, you know, it's going to be really hard for you to get there. Maternal mortality and infant mortality are very high there. It's really very sad. So yeah, it's just a very hard country to live in. But a lot of people who have been living in other countries, either as refugees or sort of as second-class citizens who were not wanted, they have come back to South Sudan. And even though it's very hard for them there, they're committed to building this nation.
What kind of hope do people have? At independence itself, there was a lot of enthusiasm, great expectations as well. By the sounds of your stories and what you saw, many of these simply have not been met 1 year on. What kind of hope do people still have that they can develop this country and build a life for themselves?
One thing I heard from several people that I think is a good sign of hope is that the level of what I would call vigilante violence has gone down a bit in the past year. People realize, you know, this is our country now. We're responsible for it. You know, we can't keep fighting. You know, it's time to sort of put down the guns. So for years and years, the situation there was so insecure that many families would get a gun to protect themselves. And then it sort of spiraled into this culture where even if there weren't people from outside attacking them, if they had sort of a quarrel with another family, the way they would solve it might be with a gun. There's also a lot of cattle raiding there. But one thing I heard from several people was that those sort of incidents still exist and are widespread, but they have reduced. And the idea is that, okay, you know, we're responsible for our country. We have to make this work. We have to figure out better ways to solve our problems.
Caritas also runs reconciliation, conflict resolution programs, doesn't it, as part of its work there?
Yes, Caritas is involved in a lot of peace-building programs throughout the world. In South Sudan, one thing the church as a whole is doing, not just Caritas, is there's a Catholic radio network there, and they talk a lot about peace. One thing that struck me that a priest said was that in some little pockets of South Sudan, you know, there's no TV, there's no electricity. Some people have these battery-powered radios, but in some pockets, people might not know that the long civil war is over. You know, they've been in this state of emergency for so long that especially if they don't speak English or Arabic, they might not hear in their own language that, you know, the war is over. So what these Catholic radio stations are doing is they have programming in many different languages, just like Vatican Radio. And they're trying to tell people, okay, here's the situation now. It's peacetime. We need to solve our problems constructively and peacefully. And they also give examples to families. They say, okay, you know, if this has happened, if your cattle have been raided, you don't have to go and shoot a person. Here's something else you can do to settle the matter in a way that both parties might feel is fair. So I think that what the radio stations are doing is very helpful, and I hope that that word spreads.
How strong is the presence of the church there?
The church is very, very active in South Sudan for many years, for decades. The church was really the only one providing services because the government could not or would not provide these in the past. So it was the church that was building up schools. It was the church that was working on water issues. It was the church that was providing health care. And that's still going on because, you know, the country still needs a lot of development.
The needs there clearly are still enormous. You're clearly continuing to fund a lot of these projects. What message would you have to people? How can those who want to get involved, want to help, best lend their support to this new nation?
Well, what I find encouraging is that people there really are committed to making this work. In the past, it might have been that, oh, you build up a school and, you know, maybe 10 years down the line, it might be destroyed because there was this ongoing war and just general insecurity and violence. Now, the people are like, we have a country. We're independent now. We want this to work. We want our children to get a good education. We want health care. We want better roads. So I think that for Caritas and a lot of other charities working there, and just for the church in general, it's optimistic to think that everything will be perfect in a year. But I do think there are grounds to believe that what people start working on now is going to have a much better chance of lasting, whether it's a school or a clinic or a good road or anything else. But it is a difficult situation, and it will take time.
My thanks there to Laura Sheehan, Communications Officer for Caritas Internationalis, the Global Catholic Aid and Development Confederation. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.